Today's guest is an incredibly well-known, award-winning comedian. You'll have seen him hosting Evil Genius or doing one of his own online canings or running around the stage at one of his manic live shows. This is Russell Kane's Wonderbox. So here we are. I'm with the other Russell.
The now second
Russell. The brilliant Russell Kane. How are you, mate?
I'm good. I've hurt my voice.
Yeah. It feels a bit like when you see an animal that's hurt itself. Because hearing you without your kind of all-powerful voice,
yeah,
strange.
I know. I just have to rely on the old guns.
Yeah, man. How are you?
I'm good. Like I said, I was shouting the C-bomb on stage the other night, and I've got an ongoing injury in my voice from when I had a food poisoning routine, so now and again it comes back.
Yeah. So you were you hocking on stage? So.
Yeah. I had a thing about the... Because my wife is, if she's ill or gets food poisoning, just one of those people that just throws up really easily. Like, I had lad friends when it used to go Ibiza regularly. I'm not missing this tune. Tactical chunder. Carry on dancing. Whereas I have to do, like, 5 hours of, soon I will vomit. And then... And so I was impersonating that on stage, this operatic vomiting, and I really hurt my voice. Like, wow. I couldn't speak for about 2 weeks. That was about 6 years ago, but it's never recovered.
And then just saying the word cunt has just brought it all tumbling back.
It does, yeah.
What? And the thing is, do you need the C-bomb for the joke?
Even if I was to change it for another word, it's the volume and aggression.
Yeah.
If I was to change it for another C-word, like conservative, it would still...
It's that... Yeah. It's all the fun words have got that, haven't they?
Yeah. Do you know, the interesting thing about swearing is, if you swear in real life rather than on stage, is a different part of the brain is activated. So the purpose of swearing, I think, based on the shit I've read, it's like a proxy for violence.
Right.
So if you say to someone, fuck off, a couple hundred thousand years ago, you'd have gone, pff, instead.
Right.
So that's why swearing feels different when someone does it at you, because you know they're hitting you in a linguistic sense. And when you wire people up to machines, if they get proper annoyed and go, you can't, it's the same part of the brain that would go, pff.
Wow.
So that's what swearing has developed. That's why it's different to other words. When people go, it's just a word. But when it's used properly, it does appear to activate a different pathway.
So do you think traffic wardens and footballers are more resilient? It would be interesting to know if someone's hit with those words a lot, whether they become desensitised.
Obviously, look at us.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember you telling a story of a dildo flying out of a Chelmsford crowd into your face.
Yeah, yeah.
After that, couldn't call the cunts nothing.
And the funny thing about that gig is that happened at a peer... The story that is never really told is the dildo was thrown at me, and the headlining comedian had a Scotch egg thrown at him, and he walked off stage. And the owner of the club was like, he was so beautiful. He went, it's unbelievable. He's walked off after a Scotch egg hit him in the face. Someone threw a dildo at you, and you've carried on. And that's why you're a professional. Yeah. And in my head, all I'm thinking is, I just really need the money, man.
Yeah.
It's 150 quid.
It's a circle of life, really. You've got the phallus and the egg.
Yes.
The gestation probably followed.
Yeah, and do you know, if I'd have pointed that out, I don't think that would have helped me at the gig. If I'd have lifted them both up and went, isn't this
It is the worst snack for a vegan is the Scotch egg, by the way, because it has sort of death on the outside and the potential for life inside it.
Yeah, you're right, man. Are you a vegan?
Fuck off.
There you go. The violence.
Come on.
He struck me, you saw.
No. I've experimented with all types of diet. I've been vegan, veggie, pescatarian, high fat, low fat. Now I do the radical diet that the Italians... Have you ever been to Italy?
I've never been to Italy. I know. Isn't it weird?
Right, if you go to Italy, you'll find yourself becoming increasingly wound up at the annoying, good-looking people shoving pasta down their faces, drinking Aperol Spritz and not being drunk. And like, why is no one fat and drunk? And it's because they...
Pavarotti?
Yeah, but he was professionally fat.
Yes, agreed.
And he was drunk on music.
Yes, continue.
Mostly, though, and it's due to a radical diet that I now do, which is called eating a medium amount of some things most of the time.
Yes.
End of diet book.
Yeah. Well, that's what you, but you can't sell that book.
No.
Similarly with a self-help book, you're never going to get the title, Maybe It's You.
Yeah.
You know, because nobody wants
to buy that.
Actually,
that would be a good self-help book.
But yeah, exactly.
We're in the era of, mate. I can imagine you, like, in an American cover going, Maybe It's You.
yeah, exactly. but no one wants that to kind of go, it might, be, I remember speaking to my dad about this, and I can't remember exactly what, and you'll love this, given your dad as well. I was chatting about, what's the Chinese philosopher, famous Chinese philosopher?
Confucius.
That's it. Yeah, I was chatting about a thing that Confucius had said. And basically, the tenet of Eastern philosophy is to be better. The tenet of Western philosophy is, well, it's something else. You know, broadly speaking, that's what it comes down to. And I said this to my dad, and my dad went, yeah, but Confucius was right fat cunt, wasn't he? And I was like, okay, well, that's that done. But you know when you just kind of go...
other people fat cunts.
yeah.
What interestingly, the Eastern and Western mindset, they did this experiment on some school kids, and you got one kid running out in front, right? And the other kids, a group of other kids running behind. And if you show that to American or British kids, they say, oh, he's winning. Look, the one in front's winning. He's the winner. And if you show it to Eastern children, they're like, what has that person done wrong? Why are they separate from the group?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's that our individualism automatically thinks, who's winning? Who is prime in that picture? Who is achieving the most?
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? But when you sort of have all those... When you have the thing is, we've never had access to more information at the minute. It's just flung at us, and it feels sometimes so difficult to figure out how you want to navigate life.
So I was out for dinner with some friends the other week, and because I'm so obsessed with science and all that, I'm a reader. Like, even when we first worked together, my levels of scumbag knowledge.
Favourite moment, hold that thought, we were on tour with Reg D. Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And so me and Russell are sat in the back, like literally and metaphorically naughty children at the back. Yeah. So we were right at the back of the bus. Reg had this seat, do you remember, that could spin around face us. And I kid you not, he span that chair around and said to us, did I ever tell you guys about the time I learnt to eat pussy?
Yeah, I remember.
And it was just like, both of us just going, I don't know what we're meant to do with this information.
So I was like, what's your favourite type of what's it?
Yeah.
It was fun. Did I ever tell you about the time I learnt to eat pussy?
Yeah, and what was the name of the lady? Can you remember?
Marvelisa.
That was it. Marvelisa.
Yeah, but the other night I was out with a friend and he was saying, oh, but we're talking about nutrition and I was explaining this and this. And he just looked at me broken and went, we just know too much about ourselves now, don't we? It's fucking horrible.
Yeah, that's the pickle, eh? But there's so much conflicting advice. That's why I love doing this, because it's just this little space where you can just chat about the things you adore. So with that, what's the first thing?
Eating pussy.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. That nearly killed Michael Douglas, didn't it?
Hold on.
What's the first thing?
Well, dancing.
Okay, dancing. Tell me what you love about dancing.
So I've been moving when I was first born, I had to be checked over by the obstetrician because I came out and my hands were doing there was something wrong with me. I was born writhing.
Right.
And I've been super energetic from the moment I can remember.
Yeah.
I've always had to tone it down. I'd like right now it's incredibly hard for me to sit still. I'm having to concentrate on being normal.
Yeah.
Sat opposite you, because really I'm not. I just want to do this.
Mm.
Had I not come from a shithole counsellor state with a knuckle-dracking, shaven-headed, steroid-injecting bouncer dad, I probably would have done something with it. Dancing.
Oh, I see, right.
But wasn't not going to be possible. Move to Brighton, get it over with, boy, Dave. So I just something I never did anything with. I was just the person who was the first one up dancing at the wedding. The first
on your own?
Yeah. When a wedding starts, it's nanas and gay men, isn't it? Up first and then wives.
Yeah.
But I'd be up first, like, woo, like I've got some sort of attention disorder where I want to show off, which is what I've been told, which is what people put on me. But as I've got older, I've like, it's not about attention. Why am I dancing when I'm on my own? I clearly just fucking love dance. Just missed it. I'm double jointed. I can copy any dance move that I see. Had no idea. Just never even. It got all the way into my 20s, just doing normal rave dancing on the dance floor.
Yeah.
And as I've got older, I thought, fuck it. It just, you like dancing. Who is anyone else to put you down for it? So I go to Ibiza 2-3 times a year. And obviously the job we do, we have to live like fucking monks. You know, we have like half a beer every August or something and feel like we're in the 1960s. So I can't really get off my tits or anything. But I have to pretend that I am. I drink non-alcoholic beer and I have to pretend I'm drunk because in our culture, someone drinking and sober is about to be sectioned.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was dating this Austrian girl for a bit, she was like, hey, we've had our coffees. Come on, shall we dance to some music? Yeah, it's good. And everyone would dance in a cafe. And it was totally cool. Same in for some Dutch friends we've got. They go, hey, look, the music, let's get up and dance. And they'll do non-ironic dancing. And we're like, oh my God, we're not even like on MDMA. What are you doing, bro?
Maybe if the Austrians danced less, there would have been less noise and the Fritzels could have got out early.
Maybe.
Just thinking, there's always a downside.
Yeah.
But what is it? Is there a particular... Is it just the movement? Do you like to learn dances? Do you? Because I'm deeply envious. I've never had the courage. I've never danced at a wedding or anything like that. I've never got to that level of... there's not even a word for it, because I'm clearly confident to talk and I can play football and I can move my body and I'm pretty athletic, but I'm...
See, I've got none of those.
...paralysed with fear of looking silly dancing.
Yeah. Which is so silly because...
Ridiculous.
...we love looking silly on stage.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. But so it doesn't make sense, but I think it's the lack of control that I find scary.
But dancing can have amazing control if you've got a precise movement. But I don't do anything with it because I don't want to turn into one of those Russells that's like, I'm also a philosopher, I'm also a dancer, I'm also a novelist. No, I'm a fucking comic. I'm lucky to be one. Of course, I will do all the TV and all that shit. I'll do anything that's thrown at me. But ultimately, it's about stand-up comedy. I'm not interested in anything else.
Yeah. Have you been offered like Strictly and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah. Would you?
No, I've said no twice.
Yeah, same.
If
you ever see me on it, then I'm in real financial trouble.
But
the government know everything.
But isn't that the worry that's how you one will be perceived, even though it's you'd be doing something that you want to do? So I say no to lots of things.
Well, the funny thing is that you would clearly enjoy doing Strictly Come Dancing. But it's everything that comes with it that you're like, he's just doing that to kind of raise his profile, blah, blah, blah.
And also, I'm not great with... the tango, the hand has to
absolutely
go like that, rather than like that.
This is
off.
Yes.
And also, this one, I'm friends with Judy Love. Do you know Judy?
I do, yeah.
She went on first week and to Sean Paul shook her ass at the camera. And of course, the audience didn't like it because it wasn't formally within the rules. We'll get fucked. I've got a thing on my desk which says, can you be funny on it? And it's like, how can I be funny on Strictly and not offend everyone who cares about dancing?
Yeah,
Number one.
Okay.
You don't get to speak. I don't have any other talent apart from that. So I'm going to do one breathless little bit of banter at the end and hope everyone at home likes me.
Yeah.
Not everything has to be a job or on stage or a profession or something you do something with.
Yeah.
It can just be for the joy of it. And that's why I still go to Ibiza.
So tell me about Ibiza. What is it? What's your perfect weekend in Ibiza?
Well, the beautiful thing about Ibiza is we always take the in. I've got an 8-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
And if you're allowed to say that anymore. And I've got I take the in-laws with me everywhere we go. Me and Lindsay either go on holiday with Yvonne, Bruno, Lindsay and the child, or we just don't go. I would rather not go on holiday than not take my in-laws.
Okay.
So we sort of James Haskell rugby past the baby and then we're off out.
Oh, okay, lovely.
But no guilt because
they love it.
Blood relative.
Your daughter loves it.
It's called the blood relative rule.
Yeah.
See you in 2 days, blood relative rule, no guilt. So we go, we can do all of the nice stuff during the day, nice restaurants and beaches and sandcastles and all the family stuff, and then just vanish like deviants into the night. But although increasingly we'll do like a day party. So we'll go somewhere, DJ dropping bangers. And I, because I'm so verbal, because I live in a world of non-stop fucking talking and words.
Yeah.
And I just stopped talking.
Yeah.
8 hours back again. But that's the one thing that's missing from a lot of Ibiza in a good way, is it's not really about sex. No one's there to get laid. No one's there to pull. No one's there to go, look at that bird. Everyone's just there to dance. It's very different to a lot of the other destinations. It's weirdly sexless. It's about the music and the party and the DJ. And it's not about meeting women, really.
Yeah.
If you see a group of lads there, they're more likely getting turned on by whatever it is they're about to eat, drugs-wise, rather than what they're about to do.
Wow, that's really interesting. Ladies-wise,
it is an island of music,
yeah,
and dancing. And then I went back. This is such an in-betweeners. If you put it in a sitcom, they'd be like, it's not believable. But I went back a second time with the lads at the end of August. Now, bearing in mind, I'm very lucky not to maybe look as old as my actual age, which is 48. But my friends are all my friends from home.
Yeah.
And they are 48. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with being 48. I'm 48, but you know, you get, it's a random card you get dealt.
Yeah.
And so went there with the lads. Same deal. Hey, Russell, we've got a VIP. What are you doing? Yeah, fuck off. Right into the middle. And then Joel Corry, you probably never heard of, hopefully. Have you?
Who I don't know.
A huge DJ. This really ripped DJ guy.
Right.
Really trendy. All the girls love him. He's about 12. Right. He's about 28. And it was time for his set and they were preparing all the smoke cannons and I'm in the middle. And word had got back to him that comedians out there dancing.
Yeah.
So one of the people came round and was like, Do you want to be on the stage with the DJ? I was like, absolutely not. Are you joking? But what they actually meant was there was a table about the size of this room we're in now, just sunk down, like all plush white, just next to it's the DJ's table where his friends have a drink and hang out and stuff.
What a great thing to have.
So for me personally, it's the last thing I would choose to do.
But for your friends.
But for Lee, Wayne, Martin and Dan from the council estate I grew up in.
Yeah.
I was like, lads. But what Joel Corry probably thought...
We've never been on a wire so far.
Exactly that. And, but Joel Corry obviously thought that my friends would be, I don't know...
yeah, exactly.
Celebi hot. He obviously didn't Wikipedia...
the disappointment.
he didn't Wikipedia my age, obviously. Yeah, yeah. So we've all got... we've been led up. And there's all girls going, Joe, who are they?
Yeah, exactly. Got builders. The set must be broke.
There's my mate Wayne, who looks like Ray Winston.
Yeah.
Lee, who looks like Alan Sugar, and has got a rabbit smoking a spliff that faded tattoo from the 90s on his. And they were just all there with their guts. And my mate Dan, who was trying to not drink so much and was having a mushroom chocolate, which had melted, and it looked like he'd shat himself on his shorts.
On a white sofa as well. Yeah.
So we're all in there like, hey. And they said to us, you can have any bottle you want brought to the area as a guest. So I said to that, look, I said to him, look, I'll buy any drinks, please let me do this. So I made, you know, in these places they have the procession that comes out with the drinks of all the sparklers in, like they do in Vegas. Something I would never ever pay for.
Yes.
So I made them bring out one bottle of San Miguel with a sparkler in it in a procession. Just one bottle of beer, which we all shared.
Excellent.
But it was such a, it was like the 18-year-old me had finally made it.
They're great, those moments, though, where you just kind of, you can't quite believe you're in that situation, and getting to share magical moments with people that don't belong there is the best, because you are legitimately there. Nobody can get rid of you. You belong. And yet, what madness has happened to get you there?
Crazy.
It's so fascinating, eh? What's the next thing in the Wonder Box? I like that. Dancing was the first thing, wasn't it?
I suppose it's on a similar vibe, really. Something that takes me out of myself and out of language and out of being a human being is pets and animals.
Okay.
It's been a consistent part of my life since I was born. There's always been animals in the house.
So who are the Hall of Fame beasts?
Well, my first ever cat was called Albert the Burmese, but I've been through tortoises, stick insects, reptiles, everything. And when I first started doing stand-up, and I was single and I was working that, I mean, you knew me then, I was working a really tough day job all day.
I remember
going to your
flat, and you had those, I remember there being a cat in the flat that couldn't leave.
That's right. So even when I was working all day and all night as a stand-up, I still had a dog and two cats.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just fucking just insane looking back.
But it's just companionship, isn't it?
I think it's more than that. There's something, I suppose it links to dancing again, because you can get companionship from, I've got really good relationships with my friends, and I've been single for 9 months since I was 16, so I've always had a companion.
Yeah.
But an animal asks nothing from you verbally.
Yeah.
It's not interested in your shit. It's just a connection. It's alive, and there is a connection there.
And it's always year zero, unless you've told the dog off.
Mm.
There's always going to be that love. There's no kind of, they're not going to be like, well, someone's done a terrible thing.
Yeah, you know, they're always mature energy, basically. Yeah. It's just something I couldn't be without, is a pet of some kind. In my first flat, before I did stand up, when I was just started working at an ad agency, they was like, no cats, no dogs, you have to sign it. And I was like, right.
So, what, at the office?
No, the flat, my first ever flat I rented.
Oh, I see.
No cats, that's no right. dogs. So I signed it and underlined it and thought, right. Didn't say no pets, did it? So I went and bought a French lop rabbit, which is about this big.
Yeah.
And trained it to use a litter tray called Barbara. And I had a rabbit that lived, I mean, how did I ever meet women? So they would come back to man. This is my pet rabbit called Barbara. I really like dancing. Do you mind if we talk about our feelings for half an hour before we have sex?
So do you, I know you've spoken about this, but do you think having all those animals was a place where you could be gentle? In a way that you grew up in a world where you weren't really allowed, you didn't nourish that.
Oh, that's a good question.
Tenderness.
No one's ever asked me that before. Huh. I'm not on a conscious level. I've never thought about
that. No, I'm not thinking about it like that, but I just wonder about the very fact that you were like having a rabbit but I imagine stroking a rabbit is very meditative. And
I'm
calming.
Just programmed. I know it probably doesn't come across at all in anything I do on stage, but I am a nurturer and a lover with a small L. I'm always the one who's, if I've got a friend who's like, oh, I've lost my job, I feel suicidal, I'm like, right, here's the action plan, this is what we can do, don't worry, we've got you, mate. Mm. I'm one of those. The question is it some sort of proxy, because my dad was such a knuckle dragger? Maybe it's a good excuse to be more soppy. An animal is like a license to be cuddly and soppy, isn't it? Maybe it is a bit of that. But my dad had this weird, you just like broken a memory. Maybe I should talk about it in my stand-up. So my dad was this like, oh, fucking day's going to be shit, life's going to be shit. 3 sets of 10, protein, boy. BNP manifesto in one hand, Poppadom in the other. I'll tell you what's wrong with this country. More mint sauce, please, Abdul. And yet once when we were driving a lot, if we ever hit a bird, he would get out and cradle it while it died, like crying, like, yeah. You know, like fucking Lenny from Mice and Men.
Yeah.
So he had these weird...
But I wonder if that is what it is, is that you can have all of that, but a dog doesn't, recognise that. It'll just wander up to your dad with a little waggy tail.
Yeah.
And you can't help but be melted by
true,
that.
True, true. Maybe it's that.
There's instantly a like, I must look after that.
Yeah, I've got a new puppy at the moment, a chihuahua. I can have my wife and daughter bullied me.
Oh, really?
A chihuahua called Brian. Because I've turned this into, it sounds like this is one elaborate plug now, it isn't. But it's something I've always wanted to write about, is my love of animals and all that. And I'm like, that doesn't really fit with saying come into a microphone. Mm. But then when we in lockdown, we were getting another cat, a ragdoll. And my daughter was like, what's a ragdoll like, daddy? So I would get the books. And you know, you get these rather dry descriptions of a Bichon Frise or a Cavalier King Spaniel or a poodle. So instead of reading out the description of a poodle, I would go, have you got a mate? Ooh, blah, blah, blah. And my daughter would be crying, laughing. Mm. I thought, fuck, there's a gap there. A pet breed guide for children.
Yes.
So I've written this book called Pet Selector. It's the most, I've done so many fun, amazing things. But that was so much fun. I just looked up the top 20 breeds of cat, top 20 breeds of dog in the UK and US. That was as far as my research went.
Mm.
Learned about the breeds and then just translated the descriptions into funny. Mm. It was like a translation job.
Yeah,
white label translation job. It's won an award already. It's been selected on something called the Library Guild Gold Award, which means it's going to be featured in a lot of libraries because I wish this had been my intention, but it turns out that educating children about picking the right breed to match their household leads to less rehoming. So I can now pretend that's why I did it, of course. But
what is the book? Who is it for? What age?
It's for 7 to 11 year olds.
Okay.
It's called Pet Selector.
Yeah.
I have a little section at the back for people that are allergic or can't have cats or dogs and all that shit. So I've done like reptiles, rabbits, things like that.
Is there an animal that you look at that you think, I'd love to have that as a pet, but you haven't yet?
No, I've always gone. I've always gone and got the pet that
Horse. You've had a horse?
I want one.
You don't want one.
I've never looked at a horse and wanted one.
Shetland pony.
Okay, yeah, you're right. Goat. I would love a goat.
I wouldn't mind. You know, my friend Brian had a goat because he was lactose intolerant. Someone killed it. He came in one day and went, "Someone's killed my goat."
Hang on, is your mate a druid? The harvest was amazing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Suddenly we're like, there's blueberries everywhere. What's next in the box?
Staying young.
Okay.
In all senses.
Take me through it. What do you love about staying young? What does it mean to you?
I've come to learn or believe that death is inevitable. Not in stand-up death, actual death. Death is inevitable, but decrepitude is not.
Yes.
There is just no evidence. There is no evidence in the animal kingdom or even in human beings that it is inevitable. You have to have 20 years like flucked in the corner or 30 years going, well, you know, we're not 20 anymore. It's just not, there's no evidence. It's just something we've all got in the habit of saying and then judging other people who dare to not start doing that at 35.
Yeah.
Well, fuck that. Do you know what I mean?
Amen.
So I started about 10, 15 years ago looking into the science of it and as well as the sociology and the psychology of aging. I don't like wanky neologisms really, but I love the word health span.
Yes.
Rather than age span, right? So my dad fucking heart attack, 62. And my granddad still alive and no dementia and no arthritis and loves to tell everyone about it, right? But it's about the percentage of whichever you get, 62 or 102, what percentage of those years are vital? Feeling young, not about how you look. Feeling young is feeling energized, excited, that new feeling. You know, when we were both starting stand-up and you walked in, we couldn't believe there was a free dressing gown in a hotel room.
Yes.
I've not lost that.
Yes.
Have you lost it? Please.
No.
Because I remember you saying, I don't want to lose it. I've not. I took your advice so seriously that I still film the buffet. If I'm upgraded to business on a flight, I still film the buffet. I still FaceTime my friends from the business seat. I've not lost touch with the excitement of newness.
And do you know what the key is? If you do lose touch with it, if you bring your friends and family along, you are then instantly aware of how lucky you are.
Yeah.
Like if you take your mum to a nice hotel and you're doing a gig, she's like, there's bloody trouser presses in there.
Yeah.
There's a kettle, there's biscuits. And you sort of realise just how lucky your everyday life is. So have you looked into, there's a guy called Peter Attia.
Yeah, I know all of those guys.
Yeah, so it's sort of that thing of, that's a big part of his plan, isn't it? It's sort of a thing called Medicine 3.0, where you're trying to make as much of your life the same until the moment when you just die.
Yeah.
Like your ideal life is you go through, it's kind of perfect, and then you die.
Yeah.
Rather than that sort of, like
great
you
tortoise.
Say...
The great tortoise would be the best example. So great tortoise lives, I don't know, 180, darts age. And but a 170-year-old great tortoise, roughly the same as a 70-year-old great tortoise. And we're like, oh, well, humans are a different species. Well, hang on a second. What about my own fucking grandfather? What about a 90-year-old you can probably think of that was playing bingo one day and dead the next?
Yeah.
It is obviously possible for human beings to minimise fragility and decrepitude.
Mm-hmm.
If it's possible, that means we can do more of it. And so far as what I'd love the NHS to do, and it's not just me, unqualified comedian and art student. This is me speaking to medical people and NHS doctors and all the people I hang out with now, because I'm involved in that world a little bit. If you were to treat ageing as a disease and dementia and arthritis and all that as symptoms, that's a 3.0 paradigm shift that needs to happen. Ageing is a disease and it can be treated.
Yeah.
Death cannot be treated. Death is going to happen.
Yeah.
No one's going to know you. That Brian Johnson dude, the fucking Just for Men dude that lives in a capsule, he's lost it, hasn't he? He's got no quality of life. He's, you're not going to live forever, mate. Chill the fuck out.
Yeah, yeah. You do have black hair.
Right, exactly. he's just like, he's going to bed at like 4 p.m. and fucking, it's like he's lost the plot.
Well, the thing is, he'll have a long life, but he'll have no life.
Right, exactly. But once you start to shift in your head to aging being a disease, it shifts how you live your life. So about 10, 15 years ago, I just learned what aging was. Now I can explain it so easy that I was like, would the Russell's mums understand it? And aging only has two components. We've both woken up today and we've had to make fucking millions of new cells, probably more, just tens of millions, just to get through today.
Mm-hmm.
And we're analog. Human beings aren't digital. So we don't make very accurate copies of the cell. So your forearm cell there today is having to do, like, you know, photocopy of a photocopy. I think we got it roughly right. That'll do. There's Russell's forearm. Off you go. Mm. Over and over and over and over again till you're old.
Yeah.
So just making new cells. At the same time, you've got to put your old shit in the bin. You have to clear out your old cells, your senescent cells, your old age cells, your dead one. That's all aging is.
Mm.
Clearing out the shit, making the new. But as we get older, more shit builds up and we get less accurate because there's no evolutionary advantage to binning cells. We should have all been dead at 40 once we passed our genes on.
Yeah.
So any way you can turbocharge making accurate new copies and getting rid of shit ones, you will age more slowly.
Yeah.
So that's what I started doing 10, 15 years ago with the stuff that's free for everyone, diet and exercise.
Exercise, you can outrun a lot of bad things by exercising.
Apart from a dildo.
No, but it's well, because my wife's a doctor, so I'm similarly kind of passionate about it, where it feels like the truth is afraid of the culture, where doctors really are in a position where they're struggling to give advice because of cultural movements. So that big thing that the NHS did when they said that being obese is as bad for you as smoking, that's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
It leads to heart disease and certain types of cancer. It's a big problem. And yet there's this kind of movement where it's sort of body positivity, which is absolutely fine. But it is also a lie to say that you're healthy because you're not. Mm. But do you know what I mean?
It's an understatement that, by the way, you are literally better off being an exercising smoker than an obese person.
Yeah. And but even talking about that, it feels like everything is so...
It's a misuse of body positivity, that, isn't it? It's like,
well, that's the,
I could say, excuse me, can everyone be cigarette positive, please? Yeah. While I'm smiling? Don't shame my habit.
But it's really maddening because you just sound like a bit of a cunt when you're trying, particularly if you're in half decent shape, if you're trying to sort of say, hey, why don't you do this? You just end up looking like a dick.
So that's why I boiled it all. I mean, it's Lindsay's, my wife, is the one that's in that world. She started a business based on it, but I boiled it down to don't eat shit, move a bit. That's my whole life plan.
Yeah.
I don't have a gym membership. I never go to a gym. It could be the most perfect gym in the world underneath my hotel room on tour. I will not be going down to it.
Really?
Fuck that. I don't do any exercise when anyone can look at me. I cannot bear to be looked at exercising, doing sex noises.
But that's really funny.
What about the pets? Can they watch?
The pets will watch, yeah. Brian's been socialised.
But what's so interesting about that is that, so you've got no problem with people looking at you when you dance.
Yeah.
But if they're watching you squat.
I wouldn't push myself in extremis with an experimental dance move while people watch it. If I was trying to like hit a fucking 720 pirouette, I'd be practicing that at home.
Got you.
Could I do cardio in a gym? No problem. Could I do 25 rep lightweight barbell? Yes. Could I try and PB bench press? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And I know a testicle is going to fall out of my shorts. I'm going to fart or something. Or someone's going to go, Nick Grimshaw, wake up. I prefer Russell Howard.
Do you... What I love, though, because I love going to the gym.
I can't.
And
I've got the kit at home.
I just love it. But I really like... What, I love seeing other people at gyms well. No?
And the other reason is, this just went so... Something like trying to... Not on purpose, just trying to help some other blokes just sort their heads out and get into shape. It's not a thing I'm doing. It's just people that have written to me and I've ad hoc offering advice.
Mm-hmm.
Is with... People like me and you, not mentally normal, very, very driven, it's completely wrong to think that other people are going to be able to go. It's raining, I will still go to the gym and do my exercise. So you've got to reduce the number of barriers between waking up, coffee and exercising. And the way to do that is the smallest Travelodge hotel room. Can you hit your 60-minute workout in there with no equipment? Yes, I fucking can.
Yeah, but what's interesting about it, it's very hard if you're used to motivating yourself through fear to then do that to someone else, because then you're just a bully.
Yeah.
But you're used to bullying yourself.
Put a cake down, dickhead.
But that's kind of what I would say. You don't need that, you fucking twat.
Yeah.
You know, there's a voice in my head. But if you say that to your brother, you're an asshole. Mm. And it's a very difficult thing when you're trying to help people you love.
But that's why I've flipped it into removing the number of steps to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Because once you realise, like, so say for someone, like, some of the women in my family that were struggling to get into, I'll never be able to do what you do, my knees hurt. So I start with, every time you're in an ad break, stand up.
Yeah.
Coronation Street ad break, stand up. YouTube rolls and adverts, stand up. That's it. That's your workout for the first month. You out? Yeah. Just stand up during ads.
Yeah.
Well, I can do about 1,000 squats.
Yeah.
Without realising it. So just starting small with no barrier to doing it.
Mm.
As soon as you've spent all this money and bought all the equipment and you've got the initial buzz from making the change, it's the worst thing you can get is a buzz from making a change, because that buzz will tail off.
Yeah.
You want no buzz whatsoever. You want a functional transition into the change with no buzz, because buzzes fade. And if it is literally step to the side of your bed and do some star jumps, you've really got to choose to not do that. It's no, oh, but it was raining, oh, and the kids, and then, oh, that's gone, because it's all in the room you're already in.
Yeah.
So that's how I started. And then I just cut out shite. I eat all food types, but I just try not to eat shit.
What's next in the old Wonder Box?
Curry.
Oh! Now, I often think, like, I remember when I first met you, you would wax lyrical about curry for a long time.
I suppose it sort of links. It's like, we've got one of the jobs that are the worst, ironically, for staying healthy, given what we've just spoken about.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever tried to get life insurance with this job?
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen what group we're in?
No, what are
we? There's stuntmen, scaffolders, firefighters, and soldiers.
We're up with soldiers.
That's how likely we are to die of mental health or physical health complications.
Jesus.
It's one of the most unhealthy things you can do, particularly as a man, is try to get strangers to like you every night.
With things that you thought about during the day.
Because in our ancestral environment, the two things that the things that were most likely to kill you, people think, oh, you being killed by a rhino or being done with a spear from a neighbouring tribe. No. Do you know what was above that? Being ousted by your tribe. Excluded.
Yeah.
And that's the pathway you activate every night when you go on stage. That's what your adrenaline is, because we're still the same creature that we were 200,000-300,000 years ago.
Yeah.
We're doing that to ourselves. So that's why all this other stuff, food and cooking and diet and exercise and staying young, is so important. And that's where curry comes in, because I've become more passionate about cooking my own stuff, about putting loads of flavour in it. And
you probably know this, because you're a deep, deep emperor of curry. But apparently one of the ways that you can make your home curry tastes like a takeaway curry is by microwaving the onion, so that the onion, because all curry bases are made from kind of onions,
indeed,
you get them really kind of like soppy and caramelized, and then you mush them up and then you make the curry.
That's right.
It does make a difference, but I still can't get it to that level.
No.
I'm not. I don't know what they're doing at the Spice Merchant, my God.
The base curry sauce, which you refer to, Russell number one, is I'll make a big batch of that. And from that sauce, which is basically just onions and tomatoes and a few of the basic spices, you can get anywhere. You can get to masalas, you can get to North Indian curries, you can get to like coconut-based Sri Lankan stuff, just from a few ladles. And the way to get that effect that you're talking about is you make the onion sauce and boil it for hours and then liquidize it so it's a sauce, but then you fry that sauce so get the oil really hot and it hits that, and that's when you'll get that takeaway taste. And also the leaf they never tell you about is the methi leaf, fenugreek leaves. It looks like weed. So when people come over to my house, like, what's that in your cupboard? Fucking Bob Marley, one of my uncles, Bob Marley there. and it's a bit, it's fenugreek leaves.
Yeah.
Methy. And I go to the Asian grocers to get it. I remember when I was younger, when it was rarer for a white person to know such deep shit about Bangladeshi curry. And I would go in with my dad, who we, again, a man of
See, that's I've always found your dad so fascinating because, you know, outwardly, like, there is a stereotype of a certain guy. But here's a bloke who's like, come on, let's go down the Indian.
Yeah, that's it.
So we can make our own.
I always said he'd BMP in one hand, Papadum in the other. He's obsessed. He was obsessed with curry, and I got it from him. And we went into the Asian grocers, and he's like, "We're making a curry tonight, Abdul." He was like, "Yes, sir. What would you like, sir? We've got this and the curry powder." And he went, and it was all like, you know, the Kill Bill scene where the guy's making sushi and the face just changes. he went, "Have you got any methy?" And he went, "How do you know about Messi?" And the door just opened. It was fucking out the back. It didn't even have English writing on it. It had Urdu script on it.
Yeah.
I never forget the first box, and you smell it. You're like, fuck me, that's what they lob in at the end.
Mm-mm.
Not the powdered fenugreek leaf you get in Tesco. Yeah. It's like a wider leaf.
Mm.
That's another one of the ones they don't tell you about. Methy.
Yeah. So what is your perfect curry then?
The Dansak is hard too. Yeah, it's hard to beat that. When the sweet and the hot come together like that. And the weird quirk in the United Kingdom of Dansak always comes with a rice. It's never been explained to me why. But most of the takeaways I go to, Dansak comes with a rice as standard.
And what would you not have the rice? Or is that fine? Yeah.
Well, I might share it out amongst the table.
Sure.
I'd rather get from a chapati. I love like a wholemeal bread on the side. I love a sagaloo. I love spinach and potatoes. I quite like a dry curry as well.
Yeah.
But not too saucy. I like the North Indian style as well. It's not as oily and heavy, but I love it. I always check where the chef's from, because if he's from Dhaka or Sylhet, it's a slightly different style of Bangladeshi cooking.
Does your daughter have this same voracious appetite for knowledge?
Yes.
I would say, yeah, because because you've got, what I love about your intelligence, you're very giving with it. You know, certain people you meet that are super smart, and there's a sneer to their intelligence. You don't have that. You're sort of a classic autodidact, and you like telling other people. What I was going to say about your daughter, does she have that?
She's got that, but what's breaking my heart is she's going through a beige food phase.
Well, she's 8, mate.
Yeah, but
fucking hell.
No, I never, but it just wasn't an option.
Yeah.
I went for my first curry when I was 5.
She's going to rebel. You know, this is probably her first rebellion, where she's like, "Dad, I just want fish fingers."
Yeah.
And you're like, "Can we not have a Nepalese curry?"
I'd be delighted at fish making it.
Yeah.
I'd cry with happiness.
So what's she eating?
Pizza or pasta?
Oh.
That's what we're trapped on. But yeah, she's just the questions. She's always asking questions. And oh my God, the other week. So she's like, she just passed through that phase. Well, we're not quite through it yet, where she idolises me a bit too much, you know, and hanging off me. And when they're 8, they're sort of this size, and still carrying up to bed. And I don't want to say 8 now. Like, you probably should walk to bed. It's starting to look a bit weird. I don't know how to handle this. And my wife's like, "What's fucking wrong with you?" Here, my wife calls me pee hole because she can't call me pussy hole in front of my daughter. "All right, pee hole, carry your fucking 17-year-old to bed." And every time something...
Can you stop that a minute? So your wife wants to call you pussy, huh?
Because obviously Min is listening, she won't.
Oh, sure, I get that. But as far as insults go, that is huge.
Oh, no. It's because I'm a complete soft piece of shit with Minna. And
you're allowed.
And which were...
But it's so, like, that's so funny.
But she's getting bigger and bigger, and she's...
Taking her to bed, you pussy hole.
So some of the...
Reading her a story.
Some of the things...
Bender.
No, but she's, like, waving, you know, bye, mummy, have a nice 3 days a week. It'll just be me and daddy now. Like, a bit of that going on, okay, which I've got to, obviously, fuck that right off, because that's not healthy.
Oh, okay.
But so Lindsay... So Minna said to me, "But why can't I marry you when I get older? I love you so much, daddy. Okay. Why can't I marry you?"
Yeah, well, that's
right.
That does need to be nipped.
I explain culturally why, obviously,
then
I explain scientifically why, you can't have children and all that stuff, why it would be dangerous.
And finally, you're not my type.
There we go. She's like, why, and chromosomes and all of this. So I explained it and just left it there, right? Anyway, fast forward to a week later, we're out with some friends, all the kids are lined up in the back, And we've got friends with brother and sister a year apart, and they just get, it's, they get on really well, and they like, I love you, brother. I love you, sister. And when we grow up, we're going to marry each other. That's what this brother and sister said. We're going to marry each other, and we're going to live together in a house. And my daughter went, no, you won't, because A, it's illegal, and B, your children will be disabled.
Like that, yeah, yeah. And all eyes on the playground just go towards dad.
But I'd only done it in that thirst for knowledge.
Yeah.
She doesn't ask. Most kids stop at one question, but Mina wants to know, but why? But how does it work? But okay, I understand we can't get married for cultural reasons, but what would happen? Why would the children be disabled? I don't understand. Okay, because there's these pairs of chromosomes.
That's interesting.
So I've given her all the info,
yeah,
and then she spins it into her own answers. And then
you're going to create such a fascinating person.
I think she'll be on stage. I'm trying to, you cannot find a picture of my child. She's invisible. In fact, some people don't even realise I have a child. Mm. I made that decision when she was born that I just didn't want her face to be online.
Amen.
At all.
Men. I often think about that with stand-up, where you sort of, you know, there's that, you know, you see a lot of comics doing that thing where they'll kind of disparagingly go, yeah, you know, one of my sons is a prick or whatever. And you think, at what cost that joke? Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, if your dad was like going out and telling people, even if it was a joke, that your son was a bit of a dick, that's going to have a scar on you.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And it's just that kind of like, I don't know, just write better jokes. But interesting, that story you just told about your kid is really funny and sweet and charming, but it's when people just give us these endless anecdotes.
Well,
I hate
being a parent. Oh, do you know what my dad said? You're making me think of that. This always happens when I'm with you. I think of stories about my dad that I could do as stand-up. In fact, it's probably something it was a passing comment that you said to me that led to me winning the fucking biggest award in comedy.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it was you said?
No.
And I was still in the day job when we were doing that Reginald D. Hunter thing. I wasn't even taking stand-up that seriously. I mean, I fully intended to stay working in copywriting. I stayed working full-time for another 18 months after that.
Yeah.
And I would go on stage, fucking survive some nights, other nights not. Some nights do get a B+. And then in the car afterwards, we'd all be crying, laughing, telling each other stories. And you said to me, why are you doing these stories in the car?
Oh, right.
About my dad.
Yeah.
And he's like, they're the ones you should be doing on stage.
Yeah.
And you said to me, you'll use all of that one day.
Did I?
You'll use all of that.
Yeah.
And I went away and obviously didn't absorb it because I was too busy working. Then I left work in 2007. And I tested what you said. I just did a couple of jokes about my dad. And every night, even when I was having a fucking great gig, stuff about my dad would go up here.
Mm.
I was like, oh my God, he was right. And then in 2009, I went, I'm just going to do 60 minutes about my old man.
Yeah.
And that was it. Edinburgh Comedy Award.
But that was the show that sort of catapulted you, wasn't it? I think that you'd always been good. And our mutual friend, Charlie Briggs, who used to work at Avalon,
great.
Who was amazing and had such an integral part in both of our careers.
Mm.
She was this brilliant, she worked for Avalon at the time. She was like a comedy booker, just incredible, and would sort of find acts and then go, right, that person's great, I'm going to get them all of these gigs. But she spoke about you and would just say, he's brilliant, he's so good.
I had no idea because I've listened to interviews with comics, and most of them, not all of them, but 80% of them are like, well, at seven I used to watch Bobby Spangles, and then I started watching Joshie Myers, the Canadian comic. I'm like, who the fuck are you? And Josh B. Peterson, the Canadian. I'm like, who the fuck are you talking about? I've never heard of any of these. I never watched a minute of Dave Chappelle till last year. I better fucking watch it because I look like a right ignorant twat.
Yeah.
I just have no interest in stand-up. I know it's awful. It's just of all these wonderful things that interest me.
Yeah.
There's two things I wish I could get interested in. So I had things to talk about with other men in comedy. Football and stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
I wish I could sit down recently I've started, literally in the last 2 years, I've said to Lindsay, I need to start watching stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
I've obviously from the side of the stage watched hours and hours and hours and hours and absorbed people like you, Red, Lee, Mac, whoever I've worked with. But I never watched anything. And I listened to interviews probably the type of thing you would say is that I knew at a very young age I would watch these comedians. I'm like, well, am I a fake or something? Because
No. But I think I remember watching. The first time I watched stand-up, I watched the Lee Evans video when I was 15, and that changed my life.
Yeah.
That was like because when we were young, stand-up wasn't a thing on telly.
That's the problem. It was Jim Davison and Bernard Manning, yeah, or the old school stuff. So when I went on stage and Charlie Briggs and all that lot saw me, I had to sort of keep quiet because they were like, it's so original what you're doing. But what was actually happening was I just hadn't watched any stand-up.
Yeah.
And so I remember Ricky Grove went, you've got no punchline on that bit. And I was like, so? Where's the rule book?
Yeah,
Why do I have to have a punchline? Fuck off. And I would just do the... Oh, it was Jeff Innocent, sorry. Yeah. Jeff Innocent, I got on stage and went, no punchlines, very brave. And he meant it as... I suppose he's ribbing me, but I didn't take it that way. I was like, oh, thanks, man. Because I would just do whole stories and go, right, and the next bit, and Charlie Briggs would be like, that's going to win the Perrier. I mean, he won't even finish a joke. I mean, it's almost Kitsonian. And I was like, no, I just have zero respect or interest in the form.
Yeah.
And I just monetize my personality. When I go on stage, it's what sat opposite you now, plus a microphone, plus whatever occurs to me, plus some shit that I know is going to work. And that led to a false impression that I was more original than I was. That's me being totally real with you. I had no clue what I was doing.
Yeah.
I wasn't doing anything on purpose. I was just describing my life into a microphone, and if I couldn't think of an ending, I didn't give a shit.
What is the next on the on the list?
So, hating on things in a theatrical way.
Okay.
I feel like now we've reached a place where it's like, why are you so angry? Just remember to be kind to yourself and make sure you're speaking nice about things at all times. Mm. Otherwise, it can have a toxic effect on your body. And I really like just getting irrationally angry.
Well, you're
violent towards things like, I don't know, fucking ice baths, for example, can fuck off. Something like that. And I love letting that come out like with a tsunami of vitriol.
Yes.
And I'm getting a bit tired of people telling me that I can't do that or that it's bad for me or something.
Yes.
So I know it's sort of a bit trying to spoil the Wonderbox idea by putting something negative in.
Yeah.
But it's not really negative. If you're not physically hurting anyone and you're not hurting yourself, then why can't I fucking really get into kale and fucking hate on it or something?
Yes.
I did like one of these self-improvement course things once
What are we doing with NLP?
It's a Hoffman process.
Oh, did you?
I don't want to spoil it, but there's a physical element to it. So instead of just shouting, they actually make you think things you hate and you sort of beat them up physically.
Yes.
I
remember him telling me about
I've never done anything American-y like that before. And we so live in our heads. We're still on hating on things here. Do you forget we are physical creatures? This is why COVID was so devastating. We are programmed to fucking touch and see each other and be in each other's vicinity. That's why this feels different today. We could have done this on Zoom so easily, but we didn't. We've done this instead. Mm. And it's better because we're in each other's physical vicinity. We are physical creatures. We're apes. And you know, to put sort of Pingu on a fucking punch bag in the gym and punch that picture of Pingu till the paper dissolves, is weirdly enjoyable.
Yes.
And you feel much better about Pingu afterwards.
Yes.
So I think people are a bit quick to keep push shit down and be smiley, happy people and not hate on stuff the whole time.
Yeah.
Let it out in a safe way. Just don't hurt anyone.
Yeah. And also, but life is, life is suffering and you can't get rid of things that piss you off. That is part of life. Mm. You have to figure out how to navigate them. And humour is such a brilliant way of doing that because it's sort of like, I know, if you have a colonoscopy, not fun. But then you talk about that to a friend of yours who's also having it. You sort of joke about how awful it is. There's a connection.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And then that laughter helps them get through it because it becomes this communal thing.
I think in this country, we process pain through overexpressing it through humour or alcohol or dancing.
Yeah.
Not because we're not upset by what's happened, but because it's a way of like you say, humour can process shit.
Yeah. And I had a line in my last special, which is laughter is the lubricant that makes life livable. Mm. And for loads of people it is. But it's fucking hard to express sometimes and say how you feel. But when you're lost in laughter, I don't know.
I'm starting to interview you now, but do you think it's more important, even more important in men? Because if I've got a distressed female friend or something really bad has happened, humour would be maybe 3, 4, or 5 down on what I would try to reach her, and normally I would easily reach her.
Mm.
Are you all right? No, I'm not all right. Thanks for asking that. Whereas men are like, it's hard to get in, isn't it, with blokes? And I think that's what goes wrong a lot of the time. And I think if you know what you're doing and it feels safe, humour can sometimes be a better strategy to reach a bloke that's struggling. You know the stand-up cliche is, you've been dumped by your wife, wanker. Right, and everyone there starts having a brilliant night. So you've got to do dumped by your wife, wanker, and then get the cardigans and biscuits in and have a talk.
Yeah.
But men are often resistant to, hey man, you've not been yourself lately, should we have a talk?
Oh, he wants to fuck with
me. Yeah. So I think we could have a greater use of humour in dealing with in trauma and therapy. And particularly, any women that are listening to this, I don't think women think to use humour on their men sometimes. I'm not suggesting stick a clown nose on someone who's grieving and go, but in a safe way, in a way that you feel is not too risky, just try a little bit of, I hate the word, but, you know, banter sometimes will unlock more than, come here, man, you need to tell me what's going on. Mm. For a lot of men, including me, I'm much more comfortable when the conversation starts up here, if something's seriously wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And then before you know it, bang, out it all comes.
Yeah, I remember my friend Al, and he was talking about his nan had died, and towards the end of her life, she had dementia, and she was walking into walls. And I was like, fuck, man. She thought she was Pac-Man. And just that,
yeah.
Little laugh, and somehow the tension's broken.
Out it comes.
And then you have the chat. But the courage it takes to make the Pac-Man joke is, that's the thing.
Something's got to be done, though. Like, what the fuck is going on with blokes? It's so bad.
Mm. There's a really interesting thing that you sent me, Dan, ages ago, that really makes you think about choices you can make. That somebody was going to kill themselves, and he said to himself, if somebody doesn't say hello to me when I walk from my house to the bridge, I'm going to kill myself.
Fucking hell.
And nobody did, and he did, and that's the note he left. And it sort of makes you realise there's this fear of being a British bloke, I think, where you think, I better not say something to that person because they think I'm a dick.
This is why we drink so much fucking booze, because it's often the only way to get past that crushing awkwardness.
Yeah.
We're a nothing lots culture. It's one of my most successful routines I've ever done is, if you speak to Americans, they don't meet in between British people. We're either sort of looking down, oh, I'm sexually repressed with our top hats, or let's go fucking mental. You got an A or B. Yeah. No one has half a bottle of wine and dances a bit. It's sparkling water or K-hole, smash up a bus stop, back to work on Monday. They're your fucking options as a Brit.
Yeah.
And emotionally, it's exactly the same. Whereas Americans are having like an ambient level of emoting.
Well, it's even the habit.
Yeah, but you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. But fuck me. But that's the most, British male grumbling.
Yeah, but fucking, you know.
I'd rather be emotionally vulnerable than a twat.
I love that, man. It was such a joy hanging out.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
Wonderful wonder box.
The two remaining Russells in comedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, brilliant.
Russell Kane.
So there you go, that was Russell. Loads going on, he's ace. He's got a new tour, it's called Hyperactive, which kind of fits. Basically, he'll be everywhere in the country. If you want to get some tickets, go to www.russellkane.co.uk. See you next week for some more Wonder Boxing.